Felicia Rashad and Kenny Lien are on stage in Atlanta this summer. The two Tony Award winners talk with us about their new play and about their long history of working together on Broadway, in Atlanta, and on film.
It's no secret that she's my favorite artist on the planet, you know, just because she can do so many things and she has such a great way of approaching the material, and, you know, and she makes a director look good.
Best-selling author Jeff Shera's new novel is about the bloody campaigns that led to Sherman's March to the Sea. But the story of how he inherited the mantle of writer from his father, Michael, is as good as any book he's ever written.
And it was my father who said, the kid is interested in Civil War. Let's go to Gettysburg. It's not that far out of the way. We went there. What happened to him changed his life and as a result changed mine.
I'm Bill Nygut. Those stories and more on Two Way Street. But first, the news. I'm Bill Nygut. This is Two Way Street. When Jeff Shera was a teenager, his father Michael wrote a historical novel about the Civil War called The Killer Angels. The book won a Pulitzer Prize, but Michael died before it became a bestseller. After his father's death, Jeff Shera, who'd been working as a coin dealer in Florida, picked up where his father left off. He's now written 14 historical novels. Most have landed on the New York Times bestseller list. His new book, The Smoke at Dawn, tells the story of the bloody battles in North Georgia and Tennessee that paved the way for Sherman's march through Georgia.
This really got started for two reasons. First of all, the sesquicentennials of the Civil War. We're right in the middle of that right now. And so starting in 2011, the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the war, I wanted to do another series. I started to do a trilogy. Publishers like trilogies. I'm not really sure why. They put them in a box or something. But the idea was to do a trilogy, focus, first of all, the first one is Shiloh, deals with Shiloh, then Vicksburg, which, much like Gettysburg in the East, is sort of a center point in the war. The third one I was going to do begins with Atlanta and goes through the March to the Sea and the end of the war in the Carolinas. And I realize that if I skip from Vicksburg to Atlanta, I've just skipped a whole bunch of history.
And because, I assume because, among other things, it's what the subject of this book is, which is the campaign in Chattanooga, Lookout Mountain, Missionary Ridge, that really sets the stage for Sherman to march into Georgia.
Well, exactly. And what I do, I don't write history books. I mean, this is not names, dates, places, facts, and figures. But the story around Chattanooga, what you've got there is a cast of characters that in many ways illustrates the entire Civil War, entire war between the states. I mean, you've got Sherman, who doesn't do all that great at Chattanooga, but certainly he's there and his star is rising. Grant's star explodes after Chattanooga, and he ends up becoming, going east and taking over command of the entire army. And then you have people like George Thomas, who are making a name for themselves. Then on the southern side, you've got this amazing contrast between Braxton Bragg, who's an absolute disaster for the Confederacy, and then a man like Patrick Claiborne, who's one of the young rising stars of the Confederacy. And so these are all the voices in this story. And it's beyond the significance of the battle and the campaign itself. It's what happens with these particular individuals that, to me, makes a good story.
Braxton Bragg he's defensive. He blames everybody for every failure that his troops have, and he doesn't trust virtually anyone in the command chain of command that is supposed to report to him. It would seem to be a fatal flaw for a general.
Well, the most fatal flaw of all of that is that Jefferson Davis loves him. And it's Davis's backing and Davis's loyalty to his friend Braxton Bragg that keeps Bragg in command. And the result of that is the catastrophic defeat at Chattanooga. And there are other things as well that Bragg does badly and all the way through the war. But that's the big one. And that's the flaw in the entire Confederate hierarchy, is that Jefferson Davis micromanages. And if he likes you, if you're his pal, you may stay in a command that you have no business staying into, and rather than letting his professional generals run the war, Davis thinks he can run it better, and it doesn't work out that way.
Well, by the time we get to the next book, which you presumably are going to bring out in around 2015 sometime, the landscape in that will be completely familiar to the people of Georgia. It's the March to the Sea. But when I was reading your book and looking at Lookout Mountain and Missionary Ridge. This is territory that is very familiar to most people in Georgia. We drive up that way anytime we're heading to Nashville or points north. And the thought of Lookout Mountain, the tourist attraction that it is today, being such a crucial site of such tremendously important but also terribly dramatic battles, is really a remarkable thing to think about.
Well, what I love when I go to Lookout Mountain, and I mean, I have a photograph, an original photograph of the Union soldiers standing on the rock, this incredible vantage point up on top of Lookout Mountain. As I'm driving up there, I often wonder, because that is in Chattanooga, the high rent district. Yeah. I mean, that's, there's some really nice homes on that mountain, as there are in Missionary Ridge. My question always has been, I wonder how many of those people who live there in those extraordinary places have any idea what happened there, yeah. What might have happened in their backyard. And that's what's fun for me, is getting into stories that, you know, you can go to the battlefield at Gettysburg, you can go to Antietam, you can pretty well see, take a guided tour. But now when you've got a residential area or you've got a town like Chattanooga or even like Fredericksburg that's grown up and sort of covering the battlefield, how do you find out what happened there? Well, that's my job, is to try to find those stories.
Let's talk just a little about some of the battles. And as I read your book, it occurred to me, it underscored in so many places that so much of the Civil War seems to be the story of generals, commanding officers, who made terrible mistakes at exactly the wrong time. For instance, Rosecrans, the Union general, came south across the Georgia border and established his troops in
Chickamauga, right around Chickamauga, that area.
Oh, yeah. And mm-hmm. had the ground. And yet, through his own failings, had to cede it back to the Confederate Army and had to retreat to Chattanooga. And this goes back and forth. I mean, Bragg does similar things. It's amazing how much of the Civil War seems to be about generals who make drastic mistakes.
Well, one of the things it's hard to realize from a modern perspective is the utter lack of communication. I mean, when you've got look at the state of Tennessee, and they're not, plus as well, we're talking state of, North Georgia here. This is a huge expanse of land, and getting word from one end of your line to the other, from 20 miles away or 50 miles away to those people, I need your help over here. You send a couple of riders out. If they don't make it, the word doesn't get passed. Mm-hmm. And, one huge advantage that the North had was they made much more efficient use of the telegraph line. Mm-hmm. And, that was high tech, back then. It was a telephone pole with a wire strung on it, and sometimes the wires laying on the ground. But that little piece of technology right there in many ways won the war for mm-hmm. the North.
Are you comfortable reading an excerpt from your book?
Sure.
I picked one out early on because it tells me something as I read it about the sweep of the way in which you write. And this is a fairly short passage, it's Nathan Bedford Forrest standing at Lookout Mountain. He's climbed a tree where previously Union scouts had been encamped, and he gets to see the battlefield spread out where the Union troops are withdrawing, fleeing back north to Tennessee. Would you mind reading that for us?
Sure. This is from Forrest's point of view. On every road, in every open field, Federal troops were on the move toward the town. But there was little order, nothing to resemble a march at all. He wanted to shout, felt a great flood of joy, could see what remained of the Federal Army of the Cumberland, a distant swarm of blue insects, a massive ant bed stirred up by the hand of God. He looked to the left, the near side of the river that wound past the base of Lookout Mountain. There was blue there as well, wagons, teamsters, making good use of the good road that ran westward along the river, salvaging whatever they could carry, some, no doubt, hauling the wounded, a great many wounded. Yes, by God, we whipped them.
It's such a panoramic sweep. It's very exciting to read that passage. Well, and yet, we have to remember that as you zero down on the ground, you're talking about men who have been shot, in some cases fatally wounded, or stabbed by a saber, whatever. There's great, great violence in the close-ups of that big image you give us there.
Well, and one of the things I like about someone like Grant and Sherman and, I mean, the good generals, and depending, obviously, on your perspective, who's a good general, but no, the general who knows how to manage an army is he has to look at it two ways. He has to look at the army and what that mass of people as though, you know, pins on a map. I mean, he has to look at that. But then Grant, in particular, one of the things I love about his humanity is it hurts him to watch men die. And I think every good general, and I'm not talking just American history, world history, every good general appreciates the fact that his job is to order the death of young men. Yeah. And if they don't feel anything from that, they're probably not a very good general. Yeah.
If the Union Army had not prevailed, what would have happened next?
Well, first of all, Grant's star, which, you know, is meteoric at this point, is certainly collapses. I mean, this was Grant's big chance, and he might not have been called east by Abraham Lincoln, which changes the entire complexity of the war in the east. You've got George Thomas, who eventually goes on to defend Nashville and defeats John Bell Hood's army at Nashville. His star likely would have collapsed. Then you've got Bragg. Now, of course, if Bragg succeeds, then he's vindicated. And then all these Southern generals who opposed him, and there were a bunch of them and some good names, people like William Hardy, I mean, people who are good commanders, they're out. I mean, they're done because Bragg will have prevailed. It really just changes, you know, it changes history. I mean, that's not hyperbole.
It would have prolonged the war at the very least, yes, because Sherman would not have been able to march through Georgia as he did.
Bragg's defeat opens the door straight into North Georgia, and opens the way to Atlanta and leads to all the results that follow that. I mean, the collapse of Atlanta, the march to the sea, the collapse of Savannah, and then eventually the failure of Joe Johnston to hold Sherman back in the Carolinas. That's the history lesson. All of that would have changed.
When you were a young boy, you can tell us how old you were, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. You and your sister and your father and mother got into a car, and your father drove you to
Gettysburg.
Right. Why?
Well, I was 12. I was the Civil War kid. I mean, I had, you know, hordes and hordes of the little soldiers and the bayonets and the artillery pieces and all that. I would stage these elaborate battles on my bedroom floor, and my mother would, you know, like throw me out of the house. But my father, we were driving, we lived, you know, in Tallahassee, Florida, and driving up to New York where we had family, went to the New York World's Fair. I'm dating myself. I'm in 1964, New York World's Fair. And it was my father who said, the kid is interested in Civil War. Let's go to Gettysburg. It's not that far out of the way. We went there. What happened to him changed his life and as a result changed mine. My father was first and foremost a storyteller. He had published 70 short stories.
Science fiction,
police drama, yeah. All over the map, that kind of stuff. Nothing historical. But he was a phenomenal storyteller. And walking the ground at Gettysburg, he knew a good story when he saw one.
Let's mention some things about your dad. He was an amateur boxer.
Yep.
He was paratrooper.
The 82nd Airborne.
Cop for a short period.
Yep. St. Petersburg, Florida. He was a police officer.
And then he was writing short stories, science fiction, and all this other stuff.
He was very Hemingway-esque, and I think he liked that. I think he thought of himself. He loved Hemingway, and I think he saw himself as a Hemingway kind of guy. And he actually met Hemingway, which was like probably the highlight of his life. But yeah, he used those experiences as a cop, as a paratrooper, to write the stories. And that's why walking on the ground at Gettysburg, it was a natural. I mean, he got into the heads of Joshua Chamberlain and Louis Armistead and Winfield Hancock and Robert E. Lee, Longstreet. I mean, these names we know historically. My father really became obsessed with finding out who these people were, putting words in their mouths and telling you that story at Gettysburg the way they would tell it.
And the book that emerged from this was The Killer Angels.
The Killer Angels was not a commercially successful book, published in 1974, turned down by 15 publishers, finally was picked up by the tiny little company, the David McKay Company, who was going broke, going bankrupt, so they couldn't pay my father anything. And then a year later, the book wins the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
And David McKay gets sort of snapped up by Random House, and the book suddenly finds an audience. But even then, I mean, for the rest of my father's life, the book was never commercially successful. It's Civil War book. Think about the mid-70s, end of the Vietnam War. Yeah. Nobody wants to read a book about generals. And so the book just did nothing. And it was only when Ted Turner put up the money to make the film Gettysburg that the book was discovered. It became a number one bestseller in 1993, 19 years after it was published, 5 years after my father's death.
Your father passed away in the late 80s. And as you say, he, to some extent, missed the great success of
Oh, absolutely.
Book.
I mean, it's a little bittersweet for my family. I mean, my mother is still alive. You know, she's down in, she would hate it if I told you this. She's 86 years old and down in Tallahassee. But, I mean, the notion, I mean, she spent 40 years of her life working for the state of Florida to pay the bills because my father could never pay the bills with his writing. Yeah. I mean, he was a struggling writer, as most writers are. And then The Killer Angels becomes this just amazing success story, and he's not around to see it.
Yeah.
And he deserved that. He really earned the right to see his book.
In this timeline, where does the Ken Burns Civil War?
The Ken Burns comes out in about 1990-91,
okay.
Which actually prompted Ted Turner and got Ted Turner very excited to take Killer Angels.
It also led your publisher to come to you and say, what?
Well, the idea was, first of all, The Killer Angels covers 4 days around the Battle of Gettysburg. That's it, just 4 days. And it was Turner's people who said, Ted wants to make more movies. Wouldn't it be great to go before and after, take your father's characters, expand them a little bit, add a few more characters? And I had never written anything before, but I thought this is something I would like to try to do. Well, I started working on this story called Gods and Generals, and the idea was it was always going to be a screenplay. So I had no fear because I would put a story together using my father's research that someone else would write a screenplay. Mm-hmm. Random House in New York, I mean, I'm representing my father's estate. They're saying to me, what is this you're doing? And I said, well, I'm writing the prequel to The Killer Angels. It's called Gods and Generals. They said, send us the manuscript. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Send them the manuscript. The call I got back was, we don't care if it's a movie. We like the book. We think you're a writer. Here's a contract. Well, that was 1995. That changed my whole life.
And obviously. What was the pressure like trying to pick up from your father's legacy and write that first book, not knowing whether you had any talent as a writer at all?
Well, there's two parts to that, because the first part, there was no fear because there were no expectations.
Yeah.
You know, we actually talked about the direct film's director, Ron Maxwell, who wrote the script, that if whatever I come up with is junk, it goes in the garbage. Nobody will ever know about it. So there was no fear going into this that anybody was even going to see it. The second part, though, is when Gods and Generals is published in the spring of 1996 and debuts on the bestseller list. Now, I'm terrified. Because I know, first of all, this isn't about me. People wanted more of The Killer Angels, and I got cut huge slack by the critics, which doesn't happen so much anymore. But, I mean, here I'm going around the country on a 59-city book signing tour, including right around this area, and I'm standing up in front of audiences holding up a copy of Gods and Generals, feeling very like this is I shouldn't be here. This is my father's book. My father deserved to stand up here and see these audiences and talk to people and hold up his book with the kind of pride that I know he had, and it's happening to me. And
so
that was
part of
that
you
was
that's
difficult.
Saying to yourself, fooled him again?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, and the problem then, of course, comes with the sequel.
The next book.
The Last Full Measure. I mean, I started asking myself, am I a one-hit wonder? I mean, is that what happened? Is I got cut all this slack, and now I have to do it again? And Last Full Measure comes out, the sequel to The Killer Angels. Same thing. It debuts on the bestseller list. I'm on tour all over the country. And, I mean, I'm still having a very uncomfortable time standing up in front of audiences, taking all of these accolades as though I deserve it.
14 books later, you're still feeling that way. And having had huge bestsellers. That's pretty remarkable.
I think I've learned a little bit more how to write. I think hopefully after 14 books, I would. But beyond that, I think I feel a little more comfortable standing up and saying, you know, I did do this. When I went back to the American Revolution, which was the first thing after the Civil War stories, that was a completely different thing. I mean, my father had never done that. Someone said to me, now you're out from under your father's shadow. Well, I didn't really see it as a shadow. It was a good thing. But now, I mean, trying to find my own voice and tell these stories, and the career is mine. But that being said, I am never far from the fact that Michael Shara deserved this. He deserved the attention. He deserved to see his book on a bestseller list, and I'm walking in enormous footsteps.
So let me read you a quote that you gave not long ago. The attention the 150th anniversary of the Civil War has received is to me a sign of the power the Civil War holds over us. I've been caught completely off guard by the extraordinary emotions that pour through many events involving both sons of the Union and sons of Confederate veterans. What's interesting about that is there are people out there who would say that the sesquicentennial has not generated the kind of excitement and interest that many thought it would. And certainly I think it's safe to say that here in Georgia, there has not been a great outpouring of excitement around this sesquicentennial. Why would you imagine that to be true?
Well, first of all, there has been excitement in isolated cases. And the most prominent of those was Gettysburg. I mean, last summer, it was extraordinary. The crowds, I did 9 straight days of book signings. I met thousands of people. But I will say this, a number of the people I met at Gettysburg said this was their first time being there. They chose that week, of all weeks to show up, that's the week they chose to be there, and every one of them said, I can't wait to come back. Mm-hmm. So while it may not have ignited, a firestorm of interest nationwide, it did